Good morning, everybody. My name is David Mindell, and I guess we'll get started. Is this right? Okay. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm glad to see some other souls getting up early in the morning to turn out and hear about evolution. We've had a great series of talks so far, and I'm very happy to be part of that. And what I want to talk about this morning is how it is that ways in which evolution is integrated into our daily lives already. I think a lot of people may not understand the degree to which we're already making use of evolutionary theory at one level or another in things that matter to society. And so when I talk about this, it's in the context of seeing how the how evolution as a body of ideas is deeply useful. And it doesn't make much sense to object to it, since it is so useful. I think, and ultimately, I think this is why evolution is going to win. I think we've got not only science, but also history on our side, because once things become useful, sort of the opposition falls away. But it can take a long time. And I wanted to start there and put in this notion of evolution into some historical context with some other unpopular discoveries. And I'm going to talk about three unpopular discoveries, the third of which will be evolution. And the first is heliocentrism. And Nicholas Copernicus, we can talk about, is the first person who published this deeply unpopular idea. You can see the publication date for his book was 1543. The book came out a couple weeks after he died. He was really sort of reluctant to publish it, a little bit like Darwin. The book actually had been written in 1530. It was done. It was laying around. Maybe he was revising it some. The idea of heliocentrism, that is that the Earth is going around the sun and not the reverse, not that the Earth was no longer, in this view, the center of things, of the universe. The basic idea had been circulating amongst mathematicians and astronomers since 1510. And he only would agree to have this published after he died. And it was put, his whole work was put in the context of, these are just some useful tables for people that are looking at stars. You could make some predictions. It wasn't, the point of his publication wasn't to change the worldview of people. Of course, Copernicus's ideas were picked up by this gentleman here, Galileo Galilei. And he published his work in 1632. And of course, he got into a bit of trouble for that. He put all of his heresy in the mouths of some of the characters in his works, and this has been a sort of a popular mechanism for writers to do. Rather than say it yourselves, you put the heresy in the mouths of some of your characters. But it didn't help in his case. He was still sentenced in 1633, and interestingly, his book Dialogue stayed on the index of prohibited books maintained by the Roman Catholic Church until 1835. So that's a long time, and I use it as a very conservative measure for how long it took for this unpopular idea to be become accepted by his most conservative social groups that were out there. So if we put this in the long context, here's a series of satellite pictures. Each square represents a picture taken by one of the Voyager satellites leaving our solar system. And once you see where the Earth is and the other planets and the sun, you can put the big picture together. So we can say now the jury is in. The Earth indeed does revolve around the sun. And if we take from the date, the starting date, the first date of when Copernicus published his work until when the Roman Catholic Church decided it was finally okay to take this book off the index of prohibited books, that would be 325 years from first publication to acceptance. Now, I realize this is sort of a an arbitrary selection of dates here, but it's reasonable. It's defensible in some ways. So it's taken a long time for heliocentrism to really become integrated into human social life. The second unpopular discovery is that of germ theory, the basic idea that disease is stems from natural causes, and it's not a matter of divine retribution. for who should get sick and who gets well, who doesn't recover and dies. There was a lot of resistance, and there still is some resistance, actually. And you think about the, there are some groups that are opposed to vaccinations. The person who first published on this, that, as far as we know, was Girolamo Fracastoro, and he published a book in 1546. The title was On Contagion. And in this, he included the basic idea that diseases were caused by particles. He had no idea what they were, called them roughly germs, and he just could see that there was some patterns of geography for who would be getting sick with which particular symptoms, in what regions of the area where he lived, and at what times of the year. But he had no mechanism. And this idea sort of came up, and it quickly went away, because there was no compelling mechanism by which people who were thinking about this and interested in the idea could carry it forward. The basic notion of germ theory was finally accepted, and very quickly, in the late 1800s, as a result of work by Robert Koch and colleagues, who could prove that there was a direct link between being infected with particular bacteria and having particular diseases. So here are some slides showing Bacillus anthracis, and here are some of the endospores from the anthrax bacterium. And Koch's real innovation here was simply a way to stain bacteria and have them show up on cells. So he developed stains for microbes, bacteria in this case, showing different microbes for tuberculosis, for cholera, for anthrax. And this was tremendously useful. And people accepted it right away, the notion that diseases were the result of physical entities, because now they could see them. And it was adopted very quickly because people then could try to do something to ameliorate these diseases. So what was once very unpopular and sort of taking something away from the prerogative of deity, some thought, was quickly accepted. So this is about 335 years. I'm not sure how well it's showing. But again, it took quite a while for germ theory from its first publication to having the evidence for it and having it be widely accepted. So we can talk about evolution also then as an unpopular theory, and perhaps the one that's in some ways the most unpopular, as it's the most deeply personal, because it has to do with changing our view of human origins and our place in the universe and, for some, the meaning of life. And I like to point to this individual as one of the first publications that was clearly evolutionary, Benoît de Maillet. He died in 1738. He was a Frenchman who was a diplomat in Egypt, and he published a book with an incredibly long title. Try publishing a book with a title like this these days. It doesn't fit on the spine or even on the cover. But it was the book title was Teleomid, or Discourses Between an Indian Philosopher and a French Missionary on the Diminution of the Sea, the Formation of the Earth, the Origin of Men and Animals, and Other Curious Subjects Relating to Natural History and Philosophy. And he did the same thing that Galileo was doing, where you put your heresy in the mouths of other people. And you can see here's his name backwards. Teleomid is de Maillet. And again, we don't know exactly when he wrote it. This came out sometime after he died. We're sure he wrote it before he died, though. And in this, yeah, we'd like to be. He really outlines a theory for transformation of life over time. And it's amazing to read some passages of it. The mechanisms are just wildly ridiculous. And yet he was trying to explain things. There's one quote that I'll read if I can get it here. So this is from his book that came out in 1738. The transformation of a silkworm or a caterpillar into a butterfly would be 1,000 times more difficult to believe than that of a fish into birds if this metamorphosis did not occur daily before our own eyes. The seeds of these same fish transported into marshes may have also originated the first transmigration of the species from the marine to the continental environment. If 100 million individuals perished in contracting the habit, it's only necessary that two should succeed in order to start the species. So it's just, it's clear what he was thinking about. And a lot of it was tied up to these overland treks he was doing from the south of France to Egypt. And he was going overland around the east coast of the Mediterranean, and he would be finding bivalve fossils high up in these mountains. So the formerly marine organisms were currently, it was very dry. And so he was trying to put things together. So this is interesting, and I could point to that, I think, as a very beginning for some speculations about descent with modification, for organic change in species over time. Many are familiar with J.B. Lamarck, who published his one of his main works in 1809, The Philosophy of Zoology. And in this, he includes an evolutionary tree. You could see this as a phylogenetic tree. He clearly laid out what he thought was his best case for descent with modification, for change over time. He also didn't have a mechanism, but this was a courageous argument that he was making, and others at his time were not making it in nearly as forceful a manner. He did get a lot of things right in his tree, and he did better than Herman Melville, who kept sticking whales in with fish, calling them fish anyway. He didn't have a tree. And then, of course, you're familiar with Charles Darwin, who we're celebrating this year for the 150th anniversary of the publication of his work and his 200th birthday. So when I talk to groups of teachers, I make the case here to buck up. Don't feel so bad. Evolution has not been in play for as long as some of these other deeply unpopular, socially changing scientific findings. So it's only been about 288 years have passed since de Maillet's publication. I think we are working through all the sources of resistance to this, and we just need to patiently stay the course and keep talking about the ways in which, well, keep using evolutionary biology throughout the biological sciences, which is easy to do because, in fact, it's necessary to do. It really is the unifying concept for all of the life sciences. Okay, so that's a little bit about the history of some unpopular ideas, and clearly evolutionary evolution, descent with modification, is one of those, and we're still going through some of the social upheaval that this unpopular idea is causing. And so what I want to do now is just turn to some ways in which evolution really is part of our everyday lives, whether we realize it or not. And I'll talk about some case histories, and I'll do this in two broad categories. The first will be applications of evolutionary process, and the second will be applications of evolutionary history. So for process, I'll talk a little bit about directed evolution, how we can push evolution to do things we would like it to do, in agriculture and in public health, and I'll talk a little bit about the notion of evolutionary computation. And for applications of evolutionary history, this is just how phylogenetics, how understanding genealogy is useful. I'll talk about this in terms of public health and understanding emergent diseases and trying to develop reasonable applications of our understanding there. In conservation biology, understanding human culture and behavior, and promotion of justice through the legal system. So here's a diagram, a picture, talking about evolution of the wolf from the wild form to our domesticated forms of the wolves. Dogs are considered by taxonomists to be wolves. And they're certainly, if you're talking about a biological definition, interbreeding may not work in all cases if you would cross, say, all dogs with themselves, like a Chihuahua with a St. Bernard or something like that. You might get into some problems. But by and large, it's considered a single species taxonomically, and it's a great example, and Charles Darwin used examples like this to show how quickly humans can take natural selection into their own hands and manifest changes in those particular traits are interested in this case for dogs. So here's a picture of a gray wolf sort of standing astride a spread out map of the world. And shown here on this map, there's some evidence from burial grounds from some pet cemeteries that go back 12,000 years ago in and around what's modern day Tel Aviv. There's some very old pet cemeteries there that it was clear people were keeping dogs and breeding them. There's some genetic evidence that suggests dogs were first domesticated in Eastern Asia about 15,000 years ago. But clearly there's been multiple independent domestication attempts, and there's lots of back crossing as well. But from wolves, we've selected upon dogs for lots of different tasks, for retrieving and use in hunting, for doing basic work like pulling sleds, as guard dogs, for herding, for companionship, and for gambling. And that would be with the greyhound, or for speed. And it's a similar story with other organisms. And here's a diagram of some forms of chickens. There's over 100 different breeds of domestic chickens. You don't see the same sort of phenotypic variation in chickens that you see in dogs. But think of one remarkable achievement with chickens. The progenitor, the wild progenitor, is the red jungle fowl, which may be just about extirpated in the wild. Wild genetically pure forms of the red jungle fowl are pretty much gone. But in the wild, red jungle fowls, what's left of them, will lay about 5 to 7 eggs once a year. Laying hens will lay pretty much an egg a day, so you get on average 350 eggs a year. And so it's just been selecting for, in that particular lineage, those birds that are that can lay more eggs. And so this has been tremendously useful. And this is chickens are now domesticated and an important part of human diets around the world. Here's a similar drawing showing what's been wrought using selection for particular features in Brassica oleracea, the wild cabbage in the middle, sort of a diminutive plant about like this that would grow in the Mediterranean area. It's been selected for cold hardiness at northern latitudes and for size, and getting the terminal buds to turn into a head cabbage, lateral buds for Brussels sprouts. So these are all individual buds, the same as a head cabbage, but just smaller. Broccoli and cauliflower are lateral buds plus some of the stalks. Kohlrabi of multiple kinds, white and purple shown here, is the base of the plant just above the root and some of the leaves. Turnip is the swollen hypocotyl. This is sort of the embryonic start of the root. And the same for rutabaga. All these features been selected by humans, selecting for increased size of particular parts of the plant. There's evidence that cabbage was apparently being grown in northern Germany over 1,000 years ago, probably used for sauerkraut. And so that's a little bit about, we call it artificial selection. I think that's actually a misnomer, the notion of artificial selection. It's natural selection. We're not artificial, we're of the natural world. But it's evolution in human hands to think about what we have done. So that's an application of sorts of evolutionary biology. We don't have to know exactly how the details of it work. We just had to know that like begets like, know a little bit about heredity to make use of that. And we do the same things in developing vaccines in some ways when we're trying to make attenuated vaccine. We infect ourselves to protect ourselves with a vaccine. So you weaken a particular pathogen and say this was one of the approaches used with a polio virus, where you infect and grow in an unnatural host species or extreme conditions in vitro, this means in the lab, something like a polio virus. So you select for mutants that can survive in an non-natural host. Okay, so it's gonna be weakened in some way, it's gonna have mutations in it. And some of those new mutants will survive, and those we can use to infect ourselves. They won't be strong enough or powerful enough to really make us sick, but they'll elicit an immune response. So we develop antibodies. And this is, again, this is artificial selection. This is evolution in human hands to select for a weakened form of a virus, in this case, that we would administer to ourselves. It takes some guts to do this, you can see, because how weak is weak enough? You want to stimulate an immune response. You want to develop the antibodies, but you don't want to kill yourself. And there's a fine line there. And there's been the cause of more than one lawsuit when some vaccines get out that aren't sufficiently attenuated. And it's not, at this point, it's safer to make vaccines through genetic engineering than it is just to try to weaken vaccines because of this difficulty of making sure they're weakened enough. But we've used this approach of evolution in human hands for developing vaccines to polio, rubella, and measles. And it's been had been talked about early on for developing a vaccine for HIV in this way, but HIV changes so quickly, it evolves so quickly that it's it can't be addressed successfully in this manner. Okay, so that's a bit about artificial selection. This is a diagram showing some basics of directed evolution. So here again, we can push evolution to develop certain capabilities in molecules, in this case, in particular genes. We're looking for particular capabilities. We don't know exactly how to get there, but we're going to make use of sort of an evolutionary algorithm to help us evolve particular beneficial traits. And so this is just showing the method. You would select a gene. This line is meant to show, just to represent a linear sequence of nucleic acids for a gene. You create a library of these variants. So here are five different genes with mutations in different parts of them. Those are the X's. You insert those into a vector, into bacteria, which will then make lots of copies of these mutant forms. And then you screen the colonies. That is, you let them grow on some media, and you have to develop some sort of a test to see how they're performing for this capacity that you're looking to develop. It might be an ability to metabolize something that's in the medium in which they're growing. And then you isolate the ones that have slight improvements in the features that you're looking for, and you start the process all over again. So you don't know how to get to an improvement, but you're just going to go through this process over and over again to develop a gene that will have enhanced capabilities. And here's some examples of some functions that people are currently working on in terms of enhancing existing function. We can select for vaccine components. These are genes that encode proteins for vaccines that strengthen the immune response. We want to get a better response from whoever it is that we're giving the vaccine to, so we might enhance that function of a particular protein. You can selection for proteins that downregulate autoimmune attack, enhance their capability to downregulate autoimmune attack. What are some examples of autoimmune diseases? This is just where our own immune systems are overactive. This is rheumatoid arthritis. I would imagine there's some people in the room, like myself, that suffer some effects of rheumatoid arthritis. This is our own immune systems just in hyperdrive. And it would be nice to be able to downregulate this own system that's gone a little bit out of whack in ourselves by enhancing the capabilities of cytokines, which we have to downregulate. Multiple sclerosis is also an autoimmune disease, as is inflammatory bowel disease. Selection for enzymes conferring resistance to insect and fungal pathogens in crops is another example. So we can really push molecules, and we're really at the beginning of developing some of these features. It's not easy to do. I don't mean to suggest that it's a straightforward process. If it were, you probably would have been hearing even much more about it. So those are some examples of using evolutionary processes. How might we use knowledge of evolutionary history? And much of evolutionary history is shown in these branching diagrams or evolutionary trees, as I'm shown here. So this is a hypothesis of relationships, just showing a genealogy, in this case, for different kinds of viruses. And in terms of understanding emergent diseases, or emergent to us, it's tremendously useful. Because once we know what is causing this novel disease, once we know where it fits within a hypothesis of phylogeny, we know its genealogy, that will help us understand how that virus makes a living, something about how it's transmitted amongst individuals within species, how frequently it can go between species. This is a diagram showing a West Nile virus. This virus was first found in North America in 1999. You may recall there were some die-offs of birds in and around the Brooklyn Zoo, that there were crows dying in the neighborhood. Some of the birds in the Brooklyn Zoo were dying. People really didn't know what was going on. The carcasses were picked up. They were assayed for pathogens in the bloodstream. A novel virus was found. It was sequenced. And phylogenetic analysis like this was very much part of the initial diagnosis for what was going on, because this is one of the most accurate ways to identify what a particular unknown life form is to fit it into an evolutionary tree. And so the West Nile virus fit nicely in as sister to yellow fever virus within Flaviviridae, the family of flaviviruses. And once biologists knew this, they knew something about how it made a living. They knew that it was likely to be passed by mosquitoes as vectors between birds and between birds and mammals. So then precautions could be taken and recommended by public health officials to try and do something to minimize the amount of transmission and spread. And of course, since 1999, West Nile virus has spread very quickly and effectively throughout North America. It's down in central southern Argentina as of really 2 years ago, and was out in California by 2002. And it's easy now to track the evolution of West Nile virus as well. And there has been some degree of amelioration of the effects of the virus, in part because that's how the virus can enhance its own fitness, by allowing its progeny some time to infect new individuals. So not being fatal in a rapid sense works to the advantage of viruses. This is a diagram of influenza virus. The H1N1 so-called swine flu virus is an influenza A virus. And having some knowledge of how these organisms evolve, of course, is very important in understanding how this virus is transmitted, how it arises over and over again, some of the same combinations of genes. So it's tremendously useful in public health efforts, having some information of how it evolves, and particularly phylogenetic analyses like this, because with influenza A, these viruses have sort of a novel way of making a living in that their genome is a series of cassettes which you can mix and match. There's 8 different segments for the genome, and these can be mixed up and still succeed in making a viable virus. So if we want to understand the evolution of the viruses, we really have to look at the evolution of the particular genes, because they are so vagal. They can go in and out of different lineages. And so that's just showing a phylogeny for one particular gene, a nucleoprotein gene. The H1N1, the H stands for hemagglutinin and the N stands for neuraminidase, but those are sort of signatures for the way in which the taxonomy, the way that the names for those viruses work. The H1N1 that's been going around recently, and then I think just last week or the week before, the WHO declared now it's a pandemic, even though it's somewhat moderate at present, they're really raising the level of concern about this virus, because we're not through with this at all as we enter the real virus season, which will be late summer, early fall. This is an H1N1 virus, the so-called swine flu, but it's not just from pigs, and it's not the same, of course, as the Spanish flu, which is also an H1N1. That lineage is probably gone, but we have a reorigination, another evolutionary instance of an H1N1 combination. So that may be more than you want to know about H1N1, but it really helps to know something about its evolutionary history so we can make predictions about its transmission genetics. And one of the things that we've been doing with H1N1 is that our agricultural practices really are in need of reform, agricultural practices around the world. If you're living in Asia and you have a small farm and you're keeping some domesticated ducks by your pond which has carp, and you've got pigs around the pond that has carp that has ducks nearby, and you're living in a house either over the pond or very nearby, it's a tremendous opportunity for viruses, and it's in a way almost inviting some cross-species transmission for these viruses. And so if you have more than one viral lineage infecting a single host cell, you've got lots of opportunity for this mixing up of these genomic cassettes. And so it makes sense to reconsider the proximity for all these different domesticated species, including ourselves, and also in some cases to protect where domesticated flocks of chickens and turkeys, how they're kept, how much contact they can have with wild birds that might be carrying avian influenza virus. So we really need to get smart about some of our agricultural practices because we know a little more about the transmission. Okay, how about evolution and conservation biology? Evolution really does help us in practicing conservation and trying to make a go of it here on planet Earth. Here are three species of protected cetaceans, a humpback whale, a fin whale, and a Hector's dolphin. You're not allowed by law to kill these or eat these. But how do you know? How do you know what you're getting? If someone, you're in a Japanese restaurant or a restaurant in Japan, and someone puts this in front of you, you go, "Ah, that looks about right. What's that look like?" Looks like tuna. Everyone's salivating already. But what if you're here in a fish market? How do you know? How do you know what you're getting? You can read the label, and you believe everything you read, right? You don't really know. That's the point of it. And here, this is another kind of meat, but does it look like a fish? It looks more like a mammal. And it might be labeled as beef, but how do you know it's not whale? So what are you going to do? What could you do? Well, you could do a phylogenetic analysis, of course. And this has been done, and I'll show you sort of a composite of what some biologists have done. You go to a fish market, and you look for truth in advertising. And so you get a series of these mystery samples, which you bought, regardless of how they were labeled. You just say it's an unknown. You isolate DNAs, and you do a phylogenetic analysis. And, of course, you have to add to that a series of things that are known. And so here's a minke whale. And so these are all most closely related to each other. And these are potentially illegal. But minke whale is protected in some parts of its range, and in other parts of its range, it's not. So you might need another level of detail to figure out what's the geographic region. Are there good markers for geographic populations in the minke whale? But so here, you've got some resolution, but you haven't really answered the question. This is illegal. You shouldn't buy this. You shouldn't eat this. The same with this sample. This is a fin whale. These two then would be dolphins as well. And sometimes you get a real surprise. There's one that turned out to be horse, which can taste very good. This is being applied more and more. You can use the same approach at identifying whether the particular kinds of caviar that you have are legal or not. Caviar are fish eggs. The best are from sturgeon. Some species of sturgeon are endangered and protected, and the caviar is illegal. In others, it's not, so you could use this approach. And it's similar in terms of falconry, which is kind of how I got into biology to begin with as a teenage falconer. My lab, we've gotten contacted by the Fish and Wildlife Service to develop some markers for telling geographic locale for some deer falcons. So we have some markers to enable doing that. So let's see. I'm going to start going a little bit faster so I can get to some of the stuff I want to talk about. Another story about how evolution is involved in conservation biology. This is a picture of one of the most spectacular organisms on the planet, an oriental white-backed vulture, which you may not know. These species will very likely go extinct in the wild within the next half dozen years or so. At one time during the early 90s, this was considered to be one of the most populous birds of prey on the planet. Their colonial nesters in Pakistan, India, and elsewhere had been in Southeast Asia, but they've been undergoing a spectacularly dramatic decline since the late 1990s. And there it was initially, of course, debate about what was causing it. Was it a virus? Was it an infectious event? Or was it something else? It's turned out to be an environmental toxin called diclofenac. And this diagram in the lower left is showing a kidney that's covered with uric acid crystals. The birds die because of inability to metabolize diclofenac. How are the vultures getting diclofenac? They're getting it by feeding on carcasses of cows that have been given diclofenac as an anti-inflammatory drug to reduce pain and joint swelling by farmers in this area. So people who are concerned about their livestock give them, it's essentially like Tylenol for your cow, but the vultures cannot metabolize it. And it's still not well known about how well other wildlife species can metabolize this or not, but it's fatal for vultures. And so we've been working with the groups that are looking at that, and we've been getting some population samples before, during the decline, and now after, and we're using some of our data to help inform captive breeding efforts. And here's an individual that's not looking too chipper in the bottom of the tree there. It's just been it's been kind of heartbreaking to watch this happen. There are two captive breeding efforts going on, each with about, I think one effort's got 11 birds and another has 17 birds. And so we want to look at allelic diversity in the historical samples, which we're using museum samples to look at, and compare that to what's going on with those individuals that are left. In part of this study analysis, we did phylogenetic analyses for Gyps bengalensis down here. And in doing this for all the species within the genus, we found what had been considered a subspecies to be a good phylogenetic species and worthy of conservation consideration in its own extent. It was considered Gyps indicus tenuior rostris, but it's genetically as distinctive from some of these other forms as they are from each other. And there's also some morphological evidence considering this is a valid species in its own right, and it really is time to do something about all of these species, particularly tenuior rostris as well as bengalensis, because they're on their way out. They breed at low population densities. They don't breed until they're 6 or 7 years old. And they are susceptible, all of these now we know are susceptible to diclofenac. And one of the points of having a phylogenetic analysis, we knew that some experiments had shown that both Gyps bengalensis and Gyps fulvus were susceptible to diclofenac. We were curious to see if these were relatively recently derived species, in which case this susceptibility to diclofenac might be a recent evolutionary phenomenon, but it seems to be, you know, it's more parsimonious to suppose this susceptibility is throughout that clade, that group of organisms. A little bit about how evolution is used in solving some basic engineering problems. Evolution is useful in conservation biology. I can't imagine trying to do conservation without some knowledge of evolution, particularly just to identify the species, and that's a problem, that's a task that we're still at the beginning of. But evolutionary computation and algorithms are about emulating the processes of evolution to solve real-world problems in engineering, industry, and science. One problem that has been it has been useful to take this approach in trying to solve is how you're going to optimize the orbits of groups of satellites that are used in communications. When you think of it, you know, a satellite's going to leave a lot of parts of the globe in blackness, in dark. There will be no reception down below. So you've got a group of satellites which you want to cover the globe as well as possible. how are you going to arrange their orbits and how are you going to keep them from colliding with other groups of satellites that are out there? It's a complicated problem. You can use an evolutionary algorithm to help you solve this. Another worthy, complicated problem is doing scheduling for airline landings. And it's not just the landings. Departures, baggage routing, security clearances, all of these things have to be factored in. Exactly what gates are going to be used. It's a tremendously complicated problem. It's almost as complicated as trying to assign rooms for doing final exams at a university. Also useful in routing data in lots of different sorts of tasks. So what's the basic approach? What is it that's evolutionary? So here's a five-step algorithm that is useful in solving problems in engineering like that. You take a population of candidate solutions, any solution. It could be random. There'll be terrible solutions. Just get started. And you have to find a way to determine which of those random initial solutions are relatively fit, are better than the others. And you set those aside as parents. You subject those to mutational change. And even step two, you could just choose some at random. Just start subjecting some to mutational change. Those altered candidate solutions are the progeny. They comprise the new population. And if the optimality criterion, the decision about how they are, how are we going to evaluate them, if you find you've gotten to where you want to get, then you can stop. If not, you go through this whole process again. And it's tremendously powerful. You can start from a real nonsense sort of solution, and with enough iterations of this evolutionary approach, you can come up with very good solutions that will beat some of the best minds just trying to come up with solutions on their own, because it's relentless, and you will work your way through hundreds of millions of different possible solutions. Okay, I mentioned I would talk a little bit about evolution in human culture. And here this is not biological evolution. I'm talking here about cultural evolution, which is different. It's a different sort of thing, but it is still evolutionary in terms of change over time. And I'll talk about two aspects of human culture, which I think are endlessly fascinating, and those are language and religion. And the first is language, and I'll just talk about how some methods that evolutionary biologists have been developing are useful. This is a basic table of words that was part of a larger table developed by Morris Swadesh in 1952. He was a linguist. And this includes cognates in a number of languages. English, French, German, Italian, Spanish, Dutch, Esperanto, the perfect language, Swedish that no one speaks. Actually, there's a growing number of Esperanto speakers, and Latin. And here are some cognate words, words you would expect to find in every language. And they're cognates if they share the same basic root. So you're looking for that this basic root is a historical phenomenon. They're shared because they share a history of humans speaking these languages. And Darwin put his finger on this fact a long time ago, that if you had you could understand the history of languages well if you understood the history of humans well. So this is the very beginning, is just looking at word similarity. Here's a diagram which always gets me in trouble, looking at the sort of evolutionary history of one of our best-known written documents, scriptures. So if we start down below here with Hebrew scriptures, which were compiled from 1000 BCE before the Common Era to about 400 CE, the Common Era, and we can trace the evolutionary history through a series of translations, and we know something about when these translations were developed, we can begin to see a picture of our history of our views of deity and sacred beliefs and sacred documents at the same way, at the same time. So initially with Hebrew scriptures to Greek New Testament, the Septuagint here in Greek, there were translations. Here's the first translation into English in 1384 by John Wycliffe. And someone mentioned the other day being burnt at the stake. He was, his bones were dug up and burnt after he was burnt at the stake. So it was, there were multiple times. Yeah, it was hard. It was tough for him, and he gave up his teaching position at Cambridge all for that, so he could go and do some of this work for a while in Germany. Here's the authorized King James Version in 1611. This is the version that Shakespeare would have been quite familiar with. There's lots of changes. The 23rd Psalm changed from the valley of the shadow of death to the valley of deepest darkness more recently. So there's been changes in the poetry, which a lot of people aren't too keen about, but there's been some changes that really have been consequential in terms of human history. So now I'm going to, unfortunately, have to go a little bit fast. Here's a passage from the Old Testament in Isaiah 7:14. The prophet Isaiah says to King Ahaz of Judah, "Behold, Ha'alma," that's transliteration from the Hebrew, "shall conceive and bear a son." The New Testament, Gospel of Matthew, this prophecy is restated as, "Behold, a virgin shall be with child and shall bring forth a son." An important difference in these translations is the translation of the Hebrew alma. Ha is just the article the. So translation of the Hebrew alma to the Greek parthenos, meaning virgin. Alma actually is accurately translated as young woman in the prime of life with no implications about virginity. So in this case, a change in the translation has had a difference in the canonization of a virgin birth, which would be a form of parthenogenesis. Translations are important. Here's an interesting aspect in the history of religions that we may be able to apply some evolutionary biology to assess some hypotheses. There are a number of groups which claim descent from the lost tribes of Israel. It's a great historical mystery. Which are the lost tribes and what are their stories? And here's just a listing of some of the groups that have claimed to be one of the lost tribes. And in going quickly, I'll just briefly mention that in the case of the Lemba in southern Africa, their claim is held up by the genetic evidence. There are a lot of genetic features on the Y chromosome of males that indicate significant sharing of genetic traits at a higher population level frequency than you would expect between the Lemba, and there's a family picture down below, with Jewish Sephardic and Jewish Ashkenazic samples relative to their neighboring Yemeni and Arab population samples. And, of course, you can use the Y chromosomes because in the Kohanim, these are the groups of the priestly class within Jews that breed true. The Kohanim will mate with other Kohanim. I've just got a few minutes left, and there's one story which I absolutely have to get to, this one. And this is how evolution is applied in the courts, in figuring out, trying to adjudicate justice in any particular case. So there was a criminal trial, the state of Louisiana versus Richard J. Schmidt, which was started in the mid-late 90s. And I was involved as part of this in getting some data and being an expert witness in terms of phylogenetic analyses. And when I was called up by a friend saying, would you like to help out on this. I leapt at the chance because of its historical implications. This would be the first ruling in a U.S. court on the admissibility of an evolutionary method, one of our basic methods, phylogenetic analysis, how we figure out evolutionary trees. So it all happened on a, it began on a dark and stormy night in southern Louisiana around Lafayette Parish. And the uncontested facts in the case are that Richard J. Schmidt, who was a gastroenterologist and a Vietnam vet, broke into the apartment of his former girlfriend. He was married. She also worked in his office as a phlebotomist, taking blood samples. He gave her an intramuscular injection. That's not contested. He said it was a vitamin B shot, and she claimed it was HIV, a cocktail with HIV, because she had seroconverted, I think it was 4 or 5 weeks after getting this injection. So in this case, what are you going to do? You're going to call a phylogeneticist. You're going to call an evolutionary biologist to figure out what's going on, and I'll tell you why. Well, let me go. I'll go back. Shortly after she seroconverted, she went to see the district attorney, who was a very astute guy. They got a search warrant for the physician's office. They went into his office. In the back was one of those short refrigerators that sits on top of a lab bench. There was a blood vial in there that had a sticker on it, which indicated it should have been sent to the lab for blood tests. It hadn't been. And that's not right. There's rules about how you have to handle these blood samples. The blood sample happened to be from one of his patients who was HIV positive. So now they had an alleged source. So you've got the victim who's got HIV circulating. You've got an alleged source, this blood sample from the physician's office, and all you need is an epidemiological, meaning a population-level sample of blood samples to try to figure out what's going on. If the physician is innocent, it's easy. This is where evolutionary analyses are best, to demonstrate innocence. To make a long story short, we failed miserably to demonstrate his innocence. And here's the phylogenetic analyses very quickly. We looked at two different genes, and we were able to make use of the fact that we knew something about their evolutionary rates. Here are the real heroes in this case, the judge, Durwood Conk, and the attorney, district attorney, Keith Stutz. There's a real historical parallel and sort of an irony in that the courts were initially used in terms of evolution as a way to suppress the teaching of evolution. There's John Scopes there from the famous Scopes trials in 1925 on the left with his first legal team, John Neal and George Rapelia. And so here was a case where the courts were being used, we had admissibility evidence for an evolutionary method to try to figure out what happened, what's the history of descent with modification for these viruses. So it's tremendously powerful, and I just make the case that we do science by what works, what's useful. It's not a matter of public opinion. Some of the findings can be very unpopular, but it doesn't matter. Nature is what it is, and we have to deal with it. So I've talked a little bit about how evolution is applied in terms of agriculture, and of course we're doing a lot more these days in understanding emergent diseases and conservation biology, and understanding human culture, and even understanding a little bit about how justice is best served, how it should go. Thanks for being patient. I'm done.